This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Morning with your host, Gordon Deal.
Strangest New Year's traditions. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka on this Monday, January 1, 2018. Happy New Year. Glad you could spend some time with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
You might have sipped champagne to ring in the new year, but in a small village in Peru, they have fist fights to celebrate. We'll examine some unusual traditions.
Presenting evidence in a trial can be tedious and often boring when it drags on for hours. Hear the legal system's problem of jury members falling asleep.
Like to travel? We'll name five places to visit if you're looking for the best bang for your vacation buck.
And food delivery trends for 2017 and 2018.
It's been a very popular Hawaiian dish for years, and it's the raw fish, classically either an ahi tuna or salmon, and marinated in a delicious sauce. Sometimes it's in bowl form on top of rice with some raw veggies as well, and it's really, really taken off in 2017.
Caitlin Carl at Grubhub on what we've been ordering for delivery. She's here in about 20 minutes to discuss food trends. We'll start on a serious note here. The U.S. opioid crisis, which President Trump has declared a public health emergency, has ravaged some communities across the country. But it isn't just killing people who've become addicted to these powerful pain medications and ravaging communities across the country. It's taking a financial toll, too. The economic cost of the opioid crisis in 2015 was $504 billion, much higher than previous estimates. How those numbers are calculated from MarketWatch personal finance writer Maria LaMagna. Maria, what do we have?
The opioid crisis has definitely become, you know, a talking point in President Donald Trump's administration and, you know, elsewhere as well. Just in the United States, it's clearly causing a lot of damage. And so recently, there's been a lot of numbers released to kind of quantify the damage. And just today, or, you know, actually late Sunday, President Trump's administration, you know, the Council of Economic Advisors, an agency within his executive office, put out some new numbers, and they estimated that in 2015 it cost more than $500 billion, the crisis in and of itself. So that's a lot of different things factor into that $500 billion number. It's not only, you know, the cost of actually treating people with the, you know, who are struggling, but it's also, you know, calculating for the number of people who died, how much money they could have made over their lifetime. So it's a pretty broad estimate. But obviously, as you said, yes, that's a huge number.
I hate to say it too, that number's probably going to go up before it starts coming down.
Yes. So we're seeing, unfortunately, higher and higher rates of people who are either admitted to hospitals or actually passing away from being addicted. So yes, we're seeing it's actually growing quite rapidly. You know, we've more than quadrupled the number of people dying since 1999. So, you know, every year it really is picking up a little bit, which is, yeah, very sad.
That's incredible. So we know about heroin and fentanyl, but just back up a second and name some of those other drugs that we're more familiar with that might be prescribed, say, in a hospital setting.
Exactly. So, yeah, some of the names are familiar. Vicodin is considered one, OxyContin. So it is a wide range of drugs are considered opioids. It's not just, yeah, as you said, heroin or some of the other drugs that we would consider to be, you know, used more widely, like on the street and in an illegal context. It's also a lot of prescription drugs as well.
We're speaking with MarketWatch personal finance writer Maria LaMagna. Her piece is called "The Opioid Epidemic is Costing the U.S. More Than $500 Billion Per Year." Where are some of these other costs coming from, or what are some of the numbers associated with these issues?
So one big category is criminal justice, because, you know, obviously it's a lot of these drugs are illegal, and it's either people who are selling them or, you know, taking them. You know, productivity is a big problem. If you are addicted, you aren't as productive as you would otherwise be, if you can even work at all. And, you know, not to mention the impact on people's families, whether they've lost someone or just trying to help someone in their family who's addicted. So really, it kind of brings to mind the ripple effect of, you know, not only the person who's struggling, but also all their family members and their larger community, their workplace. So it is a pretty, as I said, you know, broad calculation. But if you think about it, there are a lot of ripple effects of how many people are impacted. And I think we're seeing that now on thinking about it in terms of our whole country and what's the national impact of this.
How about recidivism too?
Right. Yes. That's another good point. I mean, it's like hard to even think about all the various impacts. It's just, there's so many, and you know, people, unfortunately, as you're saying, you know, a lot of people end up going back to the drugs. You know, one stat is that people who are addicted to opioids end up, I think it's that around 45% end up using again within 3 years of their prison release. So, you know, it's incredibly addictive, and people end up just going right back.
The most current numbers from opioid deaths are what? Because we've surpassed now the number of people who die each year in car accidents, right?
Yes, it's incredibly high. So in 2015, which is the most recent year that Trump's administration analyzed, it was that 33,000 Americans died of drug overdoses involving opioids, which is a huge amount. And another stat that I thought was interesting is that of everyone who dies in drug overdoses, which is about 50,000, more than 60% involve opioids. So I didn't really realize, you know, just of all the drugs that are available, that, you know, well over half end up being deaths because of opioids, because they are so powerful, and, you know, there aren't a lot of people using them recreationally that end up coming away unscathed.
All right, so you mentioned it's roughly 10% of companies who offer it. Is that number on the rise?
It is. It's actually the first year. So I talked to the Society for Human Resource Management, who, you know, are pretty much the source on employee benefits. And this past year was actually the first year they even asked that question. So it's so recently being offered that, you know, before they didn't even ask. But they did say they, you know, various experts I talked to did say we think that number is going to climb, especially because of the Equifax situation. It's just so much more, you know, on people's to the front of the mind now. And, you know, it's very possible that we're going to start aggressively trying to get ahead of these things instead of just wait for them to happen.
Thanks, Maria. That is MarketWatch personal finance writer Maria LaMagna. It is 13 minutes now after the hour. Thanks for being with us. Happy New Year to you. For millions of people, last summer's solar eclipse was a momentary spectacle. But for one New Yorker, the sight of the moon crossing the sun is a vision that may never leave her view, burned as a crescent-shaped scar into her retina. Fascinating story by Lee Hotz, science writer at the Wall Street Journal. Lee, set this up.
We all get this after image from staring at any bright light source. To sort of give you the punchline here, when they started really digging into this woman's case and really started examining her eyes, using some very new technology, new imaging technology that actually was developed for astronomers, it's called adaptive optics, they discovered, seared into the tissue of her retina, was an image of the eclipse burned into her eyeball.
Wow.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And it's very unfortunate for this young woman because, as far as we know, this is untreatable. And it's a very rare case. Usually the only time you see eye damage like this, I'm told, and I, in the course of reporting this story, talked to eye centers across the country. I tried to follow the path of the eclipse, and I was expecting to find quite a number of cases of eye damage and encountered surprisingly few, but what they did tell me was that the only other time you see really severe eye burns like this is from children who've made the mistake of, like, staring into their laser pointer.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, toys that have the little red laser pointers built into them. They can cause this kind of anti-image. But as a souvenir of an eclipse, I mean, it is sadly one for the medical textbooks.
Mm. The picture that's included with your story of that searing actually of her eye and the shape of the eclipse is it's almost unbelievable. It's fascinating. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal science writer Lee Hotz. He's written a piece entitled "An Unfortunate Memento of the Total Eclipse Eye Damage." All right, so I believe you said it, but this is not fixable.
No. There have been, over the last 100 years, a couple of cases like this reported, although none, I should emphasize, with this kind of documented scar image. We just have lacked the technology to pick up on this until now. But, you know, there are cases from the 1950s, you know, people who made the mistake of staring and getting dye damage and eventually losing, you know, vision in an eye, for instance, over the case of ear, because it can, once the eye tissue starts to break down, it can be progressive. Now, the good news is that initially this woman had this symptom in both eyes, and over a period of weeks, it cleared or healed, I guess, in her right eye. Each of us, you know, use one eye more than the other a little bit. You know, we have one eye as dominant. She was left eye dominant, they say. And they tell me that her right eye cleared, but that the scarring remains in her dominant eye, her left eye.
Maybe youth works in her favor, and this will, I don't know, somehow work itself out or clear. I guess we just don't know. It's fairly new, right?
It's absolutely the case. That's part of what made it noteworthy, both the rarity of the case itself. How often do you see an eclipse? How often is the only time you see this kind of eye damage usually? And the availability of this remarkable new imaging technology that they have at the New York Eye and Ear Infirmary in New York, where they were able to capture this remarkable micro photograph of the scar image.
And that photograph that's included in Lee's story is just incredible. Lee Hotz, science writer at The Wall Street Journal. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News, New Year's Day style. Thanks for being with us. Happy New Year to you. Are you part of the majority when it comes to takeout food trends? This morning's Jennifer Koshenka has a look at data from Grubhub, the mobile food ordering company.
What a year for deliveries, especially when it comes to food. Grubhub is out with its delivery trends analysis for 2017, which yields some interesting finds. Here to break it down with us is trends expert Caitlin Carl. Caitlin, how did Grubhub analyze its deliveries, first of all?
Absolutely. So we were looking for opportunities to play back insights in regards to how people ordered throughout 2017, and we really found some interesting and unexpected trends. And we looked at the data that was, or the orders through our data from 2017 that were more ordered this year in comparison to previous years, and really found some interesting foods that spiked in popularity.
All right, what's atop your spike?
At the top of the spike, we have poke in the number one spot, and it rose 643% in popularity just this year.
Okay, maybe I'm crazy. What is poke?
Well, it's been a very popular Hawaiian dish for years, and it's the raw fish, classically either an ahi tuna or salmon, and marinated in a delicious sauce. Sometimes it's in bowl form on top of rice with some raw veggies as well, and it's really, really taken off in 2017 and is even forecasted for popularity continuously in 2018.
Now, is this a dish that's popular all over the country?
That is what we're seeing. It's actually one of LA's hottest dishes this year, but we've also seen rising popularity in New York, Chicago, but even venturing to you know, the middle of the country, going over to the East Coast in Atlanta, and it's really starting to take over all over the U.S.
All right, Caitlin, what are some other popular dishes that you found?
Absolutely. So in the number two spot, we're seeing soft pretzels rose 221% popularity this year. In the number three spot, we see avocado toast. Number four most popular dish are chips and queso, and in the number five spot is an SIE bowl.
We are speaking with Caitlin Carl from Grubhub about things that people are ordering. What about cities? How did that break down?
Absolutely. So we're seeing a really interesting variety of dishes that trend across the city. Over in Atlanta, you're seeing buttermilk pancakes were the most popular dish for delivery in 2017. You go to the middle of the country in Chicago, and you have chicken taquitos rising 373% in popularity. Back over to the East Coast in New York, you have spicy miso ramen in the top spot. Over in San Diego, you have shrimp tacos really rising in popularity. down in Phoenix, a Philadelphia roll. So really a wide variety of dishes all across the country in every single city had a different dish that trended in 2017.
And most of the things you just mentioned there seemed like lunch or dinner food. The pancakes is rather surprising. Did anybody else order pancakes on a big level besides Atlanta?
It really was just Atlanta, and I believe Atlanta was really the only city with a predominantly breakfast dish in the top spot. So I thought that was a really interesting trend for the city of Atlanta.
Now, Grubhub has also come up with a list of things that you think will be popular in 2018. How can you possibly forecast that?
Well, we looked at the foods that were rising in popularity month over month. So, you know, those were those foods that we saw people that began to order in January, and come October, November, we're really seeing that these are really hot dishes for delivery. And in that number one spot, we see lettuce chicken wraps that rose 184% in an average monthly popularity in 2017. And we're seeing that lettuce chicken wraps may be on track for great popularity in 2018.
Caitlin, you also have a list of trendy dishes for delivery. What are some of those?
Yes. So we see, in line with National Culinary Reports, that vegetable entrees, so we're talking about spaghetti squash, jackfruit, zucchini noodles, cauliflower steaks, are really going to be popular in 2018 as well. And these are what those National Culinary Reports are saying, and we're seeing it in delivery as well. So it's not only something that you're preparing at your home, but those vegetable entrees are making their way to the delivery bags as well.
Maybe we're getting a little tiny bit healthier.
It does sound like that. But, of course, you have to balance it out. We see that on track for 2018, you have your spicy tonkatsu ramen. You have Korean fried chicken wings, a brisket sandwich, all on track to rise in popularity in 2018. So I think life is all about balance. You have your vegetable entrees, but you also have these really rich, delicious dishes.
That's Caitlin Carl of Grubhub with this morning's Jennifer Koshenka. 30 minutes after the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
Give your employees the power to do their best work and maximize this year's budget when you update to new, powerfully performing Dell Business PCs with Intel Core processors. Dell's dedicated small business advisors mean you'll always get the best deal on the right solution for your business. Get up to 35% off select business PCs now until the end of December. Did I mention there's free shipping? Visit Dell.com/smallbusiness or call 877-BUY-DELL. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for spending time with us on this Monday, January 1st, New Year's Day 2018. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. Places that deal-hungry travelers should pay a visit to in 2018. Also, the problem of sleeping jurors during trials and the strangest New Year's traditions from around the world. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Here's the summary of a new study of millennials and their political leanings. Three words: more government, please. Largely because of such millennials, generally those born in the 1980s and 90s, socialism has moved from being taboo because of its associations with the Cold War to something that has found rising appeal among those polled by Harvard and in other surveys that compared different generations. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Eli Stokels. Eli, what do we have?
Well, there's always this perception that young people are more liberal, progressive, and get more conservative as they get older. What has been borne out by a lot of polling over several years now is that we don't know what these people are going to do when they get older, but we know that these younger folks, a lot of people call them millennials, are showing signs that they are increasingly open to embracing more European-style governments, Last year, 42% of younger Americans polled by Harvard University, which has polled millennials for 16 years now, 42% said they support capitalism. Only 19% identified themselves as capitalists. And you have to put this in the historical context. This is a generation that is coming of age, looking for jobs, graduating college, just years after this financial crisis. In this period of slow economic growth, they are people who are trying to find jobs, thinking about buying homes, starting families, probably not going to have a ton of money in the stock market. So the you know, shooting Dow going up, that's not something that is really tangible to them. And they also grew up post-Cold War, most of them coming of age after the Reagan presidency, after the demise of the Soviet Union. And so they did not grow up as people in the 60s, 70s, and 80s did, sort of hearing about how socialism is bad. So this helps explain perhaps the rise of Bernie Sanders, the success of Bernie Sanders' campaign last year as a you know, open, self-referential democratic socialist.
Did we see any sharp changes in the poll?
It was sort of held steady for a long time, and then the last 2 years really plunged the number of young people who believe that tax cuts will create economic growth. Just a lot more skepticism in recent years about supply-side economics. Perhaps that's the result of voices like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders gaining resonance. Perhaps it's a combination of that and the factors and the day-to-day experiences of these people in the workforce.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal White House reporter Eli Stokols. His piece is called Socialism and Capitalism Seen in New Light by Younger Americans. You hinted at it in one of your remarks there, but I'm going to read a line from this story that really jumped out at me. Millennials want a bigger role for government in making conditions better for their future. I mean, do they think the current government runs well, I guess the cynic in me would ask?
Well, they are skeptical. I mean, this is nuanced, right, because they are very skeptical of institutions, the Iraq War, and a lot of, you know, their growing up was something that made them skeptical that the government and the military will always do the right thing. But, you know, the financial crisis, a lot of things that make them skeptical about government. But when a lot of the polling and the things that we looked at, you know, there are these questions that these young people get asked, and more and more we're seeing them say yes when asked, you know, is it worth combating climate change even if it you know, impedes economic growth and there's an economic cost. More people are saying yes. Fewer people are saying that tax cuts will spark economic growth, as I mentioned. More people are just open to government doing more things to help low and middle income families in terms of a social safety net.
You said the sea change is underway and it will continue to develop, I guess. Did anybody see the millennials kind of putting up their own a presidential candidate, for example?
Well, so John Delavolpe, who's the pollster who's conducted the Harvard survey for 16 years now, really does believe that 2018 and perhaps 2020 are sort of the last chance for the traditional Democratic and Republican parties to make real inroads with these voters. When you talk to young voters, they're not really enamored of either party. I think it looks better for Democrats at the moment, but, you know, they have to do a better job. Hillary Clinton did not really appeal to these young people the way Bernie Sanders did. Yeah. And perhaps it was Bernie's ideas, but a lot of young people said it was also his authenticity, right? He's older than Hillary Clinton. It's not his age. He's not of this generation, but he was more in sync with the younger voters.
Thanks, Eli. Eli Stokols, Wall Street Journal, White House reporter. 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Happy New Year. Welcome into January 1. As the economy and job market improve, many Americans are adding international travel to their to-do lists since it was once perceived as too pricey. And they'll likely spend big. The average American who takes a trip will drop more than $3,200 for an international vacation that averages 12 nights. So where are the bargains in 2018? We're joined now by Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com, who's found a handful. Katie, what have you discovered?
Yeah, this is where, relative to past years, you might find some kind of prices, flight prices, hotel prices, something a little bit lower in 2018 than you would have in past years. So while not all of these are going to be dirt cheap, they might be cheaper than in previous years. Number one on the list, this keeps popping up on a variety of lists, so I really want to call it out. But Nicaragua, amazing beaches. Look, I had a couple people tell me this is the next Costa Rica. Tourists just don't really know it yet. But there are tons of flight deals to Nicaragua. I mean, I just did a really quick search when I was writing the story. Spirit had one from New York for $265 round trip. Great beaches. I found some private islands you could rent for under $200 a night, which I ended up doing a whole separate piece on. But yeah. Nicaragua has great deals, and you can find some spectacular flight deals, not just now, but the experts are predicting throughout this year you're going to be finding some really good round-trip fares to Nicaragua.
It sounds great, but the cynic in me says, is there a reason that they're so cheap? Like drugs and crime, are those issues there?
I mean, they used to be much worse, so it's gotten much safer. But again, this isn't on people's radars that much. I mean, some people, I've had a few friends go, but this isn't like, you know, it's not hit Iceland level yet. You probably see everyone on your, you know, Facebook feed going to Iceland. This hasn't hit that. Yeah, but here, you know, here's a quote from one of my great travel sources. It has everything that Costa Rica has, but tourists just don't know it yet. I bet in 3 to 5 years, it will be almost the same prices as Costa Rica. I mean, he might be being overly optimistic about that, but yeah, I mean, in a way, he's right. I mean, there's so much of that great nature. There's these beautiful beaches, and it's still just so, so affordable.
Wow. We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. What else made the list?
Spain. I thought for the foodie, this is perfect, right? You probably can't afford to go to France. We all wish we could, but we can't. The good thing with Spain right now is that flight prices for both Madrid and Barcelona are trending way cheaper than they were at this time last year. Barcelona's were down about 20% for the first half of 2018 compared to the same time last year. So the flight deals going there are really cheap. And look, I mean, Spain is a much cheaper option than a lot of other countries in Western Europe on everything from food to accommodations. By the way, there's tons of Airbnbs throughout Spain. So yeah, this might be really the year to go. And it's an easy place to travel with tons of different kinds of things to do.
Again, the cynic in me would ask, are there, you know, the cheap flights or whatever, concerns about terrorism? Like, is tourism down? So this is the bait to try to get you back?
Spain's had a rough economic go at this, right? They still have a 17% unemployment rate. So part of, you know, they really need tourists coming in there. And that, you know, in that economy kind of keeps the prices depressed compared to a lot of other Western European countries. I've been to Spain a few times. I never felt, you know, scared or anything of the sort. And I found it quite easy to travel in and a pretty awesome place to go, frankly.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. The right to a jury trial is a pillar of America's justice system, right? Enshrined in the Constitution from a tradition dating back more than 1,000 years. The problem these days is making sure jurors stay awake. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Nicole Hong, who's covered cases recently and spotted sleeping jurists. Nicole, what have you noticed?
So this started when I was following two big trials in New York in federal court. And in the same week, judges in both of those trials had dismissed jurors for sleeping. And one of the trials, I actually saw the jurors sleeping through most of the testimony. And I just found this sort of amusing, and I thought I would look into this a little bit deeper. And as I was talking to lawyers and former judges, a lot of them were saying this is a very common problem that everyone has to deal with in the courtroom.
I can understand that, I guess, to a certain extent, because some of the presentations, one, I guess, are boring, and two, the material can be so complicated, right? It just could go right over your head and just easily lose concentration.
Yeah, totally. Like the one I was covering, it's about U.S. sanctions against Iran, and it's really focused on, you know, bank records and spreadsheets, and the jurors are sitting there on these chairs for like hours at a time. They're not allowed to walk around, and especially if it's after lunch, it's kind of like sitting in a college lecture. I mean, we've probably all fallen asleep during a lecture
in
school, so it's like that, but it's every single day for weeks at a time, especially for these really complicated federal trials.
Boy,
so I totally understand why it happens, but it's just a funny thing to see lawyers and judges kind of deal with it delicately in court when it does.
Yeah, because as you say, it's a tricky balance. You run, I guess, some sort of risk if you're a lawyer who like barks at a juror to wake up, right? Then you could turn the juror against you, I guess.
Totally. And the lawyers I talked to said there are sort of sensitive, delicate ways you can bring it up with the judge at a sidebar or, you know, kind of tell people about it private and have the judge deal with it so that the juror doesn't get pissed off at either side. But it is funny for audience members watching the trial, if there's someone just blatantly sleeping for days at a time, then you really have to do something about it.
So how much of this perhaps falls on the way lawyers present material? Maybe they're not the best presenters. They're boring.
Well, I think also part of the issue is just the way trials play out in real life. It's completely not the way it's portrayed in like Law and Order or these movies. You have to, every single thing that's admitted into evidence has to enter the record somehow. So these witnesses will be up there, and it's just like a very laborious back and forth of like, is this the gun? Yes. Is this the blood on the shirt? Yes. So it's very meticulous, and it has to be that way. It's just required by law. So it's just real trials drag on for a while because there's just, you just have to get all the information into the record.
Sleeping jurors. From Wall Street Journal reporter Nicole Hong. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News on this New Year's Day. Thanks for being with us. Strangest New Year's traditions from around the world from list25.com. In Denmark, they save all their unused dishes and plates until the 31st of December when they affectionately shatter them against the doors of all their friends and family. In Ecuador, they celebrate the new year by burning paper-filled scarecrows at midnight, all in the name of good fortune. In Spain, stuff 12 grapes in your mouth at midnight to achieve good luck for the next year. In some South American countries, wearing colored underwear will determine your fate for the new year. Gold means wealth, red means love. Every year at the end of December, people in a small village in Peru fist fight to settle their differences. Then they start the year off on a clean slate. In some parts of Puerto Rico, they throw pails of water out of their windows to drive away evil spirits. Perhaps not surprisingly, in Siberia, they jump into frozen lakes carrying tree trunks. And in Estonia, it's all about eating the New Year's tradition's food. People eat 7 times on New Year's Day to ensure abundance in the new year. Surely I'm part Estonian. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Gordon Deal. Happy New Year. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.